From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the new immigration orders from Homeland Security, putting the Trump immigration crackdown in place.
There was a lot of focus on targeting the undocumented individuals, but there was no mention of targeting the employers.
And the view from Michigan's restaurant owners.
In an industry that is already struggling to find qualified and available people, this might make it more difficult.
As the state explores closing 38 failing schools, parents push back.
As one parent put it to me, "Congratulations, state, you found where the poverty is."
And the legacy of Scots immigrants who came to Flint a century ago seeking work in the new auto plants.
There wasn't a lot of work in the old country. They came here looking for a better life, just like immigrants today.
Those stories and more for you today on Stateside. But first, the news. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The Snyder administration says it wants to close up to 38 low-performing schools. Maybe. They're not sure yet what they want to do exactly or what viable alternatives are out there for affected families. And that muddled message has left parents and their children in the dark about what their futures hold. Later in the hour, we break down what's happening with the school closings with Michigan Radio reporters Jen Guerra and Lindsay Smith. But first, within days of being sworn into office, President Trump signed executive orders calling for tougher enforcement of immigration laws and beefed up border security. Well, now Homeland Security Secretary John Kelly has signed off on new rules that show us how the government will implement this immigration crackdown. With us now is Brad Thompson, an immigration attorney based in Ann Arbor. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for inviting me.
Critics say these new DHS orders put every undocumented immigrant in this country at risk of being deported, a mass deportation blueprint, we've heard. The White House says, no, that's not so. The priority will be people who've committed a crime or who pose what they call a threat to our public safety. Between these opposing views, where do you think these new orders from the Secretary Kelly lie?
A plain reading of the memo actually includes not only unauthorized documents, but under the Immigration Nationality Act, the term alien means any person not a citizen or national of the United States. So this order, red, black, and white, could potentially apply to permanent residents, anyone here on a work visa, and obviously anyone who is here undocumented.
What surprises you most about these orders?
What surprises me most is the sheer volume of people that will be affected by this. If estimates say that there's somewhere between 8 and 14 million undocumented people, the majority of these undocumented immigrants have legal citizen family members. I would estimate 2 or 3 per family. So taking those numbers, you're looking at literally 10% of the population will be affected directly. And it's not just these families. It's people who work with these people, the community members, go to religious services. So there's going to be a tremendous amount of people affected by this order.
What is your take? And again, it's early. These have just come out. But what's your take on how these orders are going to be enforced?
I'm very interested as to where the money is going to come from. Literally, it was going to take hundreds of billions of dollars if they were to deport every single person who is a priority for deportation under this memo. So it'll be interesting how the government applies this memo and puts it into reality.
What kind of calls are you getting now? What kind of questions are your clients asking?
There's been an absolute earthquake of fear and anxiety pretty much from every single client that is calling my office. I've never been so overwhelmed with the amount of volume of calls coming into my office. And it's not only the undocumented immigrants, but it's my clients who I'm in the middle of the process. They are terrified, too, as to how this memo will affect their immigration process.
Give us an idea of some of the stories behind these calls. So without getting into the names of people, but the kind of situations that you know people are in, that your clients are in.
For example, clients who are in immigration court removal proceedings defending against deportation, for example, with an asylum case or a case based on having more than 10 years here and U.S. citizen family members, they're terrified to show up to their ICE supervision meetings. When I say ICE, that's Immigration and Customs Enforcement, because recently ICE has been much more active in detaining clients. In fact, just in the past couple of weeks, I've had 2 clients show up to a routine ICE visit, and they were detained and put in jail just for showing up to their order of supervision.
We saw that big national story out of Phoenix where a mother officer showed up for her regular meeting, as she had done for years, and she was handcuffed and she was deported and had to leave her children behind. So you're expecting this to be become more commonplace.
Yes, absolutely.
What are you advising people?
I'm advising the people to be patient, but at the same time, do everything that they can to protect themselves, whether that means fixing their immigration status if they can, or just understanding what their basic rights are and having a plan in case they have contact with immigration. For example, what is the plan for your children if you get detained and when your child is at school, who is going to pick them up from school?
Is it hard to figure it out in the sense of you've got these sketches, if you will, these orders that Homeland Security Secretary Kelly signed, but it's not all there yet, right? I mean, do you have a sense of, I'm not sure where this is going to go?
It is, in terms of, I have no idea how the government is going to be able to process all these individuals through the removal process, because the law still states that you have your right to your day in court if you're here in the United States and you get picked up by immigration. For example, right now, there's more than 500,000 pending immigration court cases across the country. The average pending case is 2 years. I had one case in my office that had been pending 8 years. So if they're already this backlogged, and in the state of Michigan, there's only 3 immigration judges and approximately a dozen government attorneys working in the immigration court. So the memo addresses a lot of additional resources for officers to place people into removal proceedings and to try to execute the deportation of them. But what I'm curious to see is how the courts and Immigration Customs Enforcement is going to adapt to the realities of the large volume of people that will be in removal proceedings.
And aren't we hearing now that the shift is going to be deport first and we'll deal with your court case while you're back across the border?
That is part of that, but there's different rights for if someone's coming to the border and, for example, requesting asylum than if someone is already here inside the United States. So, yes, there is going to be less opportunity for people to make asylum cases who are coming to the border. They're going to tremendously increase the use of expedited removal to, in essence, speed up the process of deportation at the border, especially as it relates to the children who are coming to the border to seek asylum.
Are you seeing people rethinking their asylum requests?
I am seeing people very concerned about their asylum request. What was stated in this memo, actually, is it's not just the children that are going to be affected, but if a parent, for example, sends money to a human smuggler to bring them here to the United States, they can actually be now criminally prosecuted for that. So absolutely, I'm sure people are going to think twice about coming and applying for asylum.
And yet we know that there are people saying, good, that's illegal. They look at it, this is illegal. Follow the rules. What do you say when you encounter people with that perspective who are very much in favor of the president's policies?
Well, we have to look at the realities of the situation as where we are today and where we want to be in the future. Donald Trump has a sledgehammer-type approach to this rather than a scalpel-type approach. Yes, no one here in the United States who is a law-abiding citizen wants severe criminals who are immigrants in our community. However, what is the reality of this situation is it basically authorizes the government, and in the eyes of the undocumented community, it's creating a police state where anyone and everyone can be prosecuted and deported. And so there's a huge concern as to what will happen in the future if this is truly enacted in the black letter of the law.
One of the parts of this order is that it would use local police to help out, to be part of this this effort in cracking down. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, the memo states that under the 287G program, it allows qualified state or local law enforcement officer to be designated as an immigration officer for purposes of enforcing federal immigration law. As a result, such officers have the authority to perform all law enforcement functions, including the authority to investigate, identify, apprehend, arrest, and detain, and conduct searches of immigrants. the reality of this is if they implement this policy, immigrants are going to be terrified to call the police if they are a victim of crime. So the intent of this memo is to help assist national security, but I believe the net result will – it'll actually potentially increase the amount of unreported crime.
So this is really, in essence, pushing people much further underground.
And it also creates a huge distrust of local police officers. It's already marginalized enough, and it will increase the chance that people will take advantage of undocumented immigrants because they know that they won't go to the police to report any potential crimes.
Will these orders, do you think, solve the issue of illegal immigration?
Absolutely not, because there's still a lot of problems with, for example, workplace enforcement. So this may create tremendous fear and anxiety. But if you have people here who have been here 20, 30 years, they're not just going to voluntarily leave and go home. And then also the other issue that I have with this is there was a lot of focus on targeting the undocumented individuals, but there was no mention of targeting the employers who are hiring the undocumented immigrants. So it'll be interesting how Trump's policy approaches the business owners. It's also an issue where the left does not want the immigrants deported because of the families that will be separated, and the right doesn't want the immigrants deported because it will be bad for the economy. So we really want to see what will happen.
Brad Thompson is an immigration attorney based in Ann Arbor. Brad, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Restaurants and resorts all across Michigan depend on immigrants. What could the new Trump immigration policies mean for them? With us now, Justin Winslow, who's president and CEO of the Michigan Restaurant Association. Justin, welcome.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, here in Michigan, we have, what, some 425,000 workers in the restaurant industry?
That's correct.
Do you have a sense of how many of them would be affected by these new immigration orders?
Nationally, the statistics are a little over 1 in 5 people working in the industry are foreign-born.
How significant do you think these new executive orders are to the restaurant industry?
Very significant. It's difficult to know exactly what new orders will be from the Trump administration, at least as we are talking right now. But I can talk more generally to the difficulty this industry is going to have filling necessary jobs going forward. I mean, the simple fact is over the next decade, restaurants will likely create more jobs than U.S.-born workforce can fill, period.
And you're really already dealing with labor issues in the restaurant industry, aren't you?
That's correct. Yeah, you're looking at a need for about a 14% increase in actual job growth over the next 10 years, while U.S.-born workforce numbers grow at about 10% over that same period. Making it increasingly difficult for this industry is that we have the youngest workforce of any sector in the economy, and all signs are pointing to that demographic, that age 16 to 24-year-old, is decreasing from the workforce, actually declining about 3 million people nationally over that time period. That's a challenge.
What are you hearing from members as you talk to restaurant and resort owners? What are they saying to you?
We need help finding qualified and capable individuals to work in our restaurants. Restaurants overall are growing. I mean, as you had mentioned earlier, 425,000 people is 11% of the workforce, and we're going to grow at a faster rate than the overall economy over the next decade as well. So they know this challenge exists. They're looking for help to find qualified and available new employees.
And so has the MRA taken a stance on these latest orders yet, or do you plan to, perhaps in conjunction with the National Restaurant Association?
Probably not specifically on the orders as it relates to us, the state association. Mm-hmm. Our national association is actively involved on the immigration issue overall, but it's difficult to say where they ultimately will land.
So, all right, what kind of thoughts are you having as far as you say, perhaps not the particular orders, but just kind of a general position that you want to take?
Well, so I'll put this out there. The NRA, the National Restaurant Association, important to clarify that that the NRA here is the Restaurant Association, does a monthly tracking survey. And last month, 27% of our restaurant operators said recruiting and retaining employees is the single most important challenge facing their business. That number was just 9% 2 years ago. So it is a growing theme. It's a growing problem. And we're concerned that this may make things more difficult.
I know it's very early to get a handle on the impact of these new orders and this shift in immigration enforcement, but if it's as broad as analysts are saying, that it could just about mean anyone in the country without proper papers, it could be deported, what impact do you think this could have on the restaurant industry in Michigan, and how would people feel this effect?
That's an excellent question. It will have an effect. A little more than 1 in 5 overall people working in the industry are foreign-born. I don't have Michigan numbers specifically, and I apologize for that, but I think you can assume that it is a number similar to that. So that's in an industry that is already struggling to find qualified and available people, this might make it more difficult.
What are you going to look for going forward?
Clarity. would be certainly appreciated. We would like to see a clear path of immigration reform, you know, for legal and illegal immigration. There are visa issues that this industry faces, specifically the hospitality side of the industry up north. Pure Michigan has been a massive success, and we find issues each summer trying to actually fill the jobs needed to make those resorts on Mackinac Island and some of our other resorts in our great up north area succeed. The general population up there certainly can't do it by themselves.
There's a ripple effect here that I'm hearing you describe.
Yes, it affects all aspects of this industry and, frankly, probably others as well.
Justin Winslow is the president and the CEO of the Michigan Restaurant Association. Justin, thank you so much for taking our questions.
Oh, I appreciate it. Thanks for the time.
They came from quiet glens in Scotland to mid-Michigan, seeking jobs in the new auto plants in Flint. And they left a legacy that is going strong over a century later. That's Pipe Major Dennis Lowe, who leads the Flint Scottish Pipe Band, the oldest Highland pipe band in Michigan and 11th oldest in the nation. This band has been piping and drumming for over 100 years in Flint. So with us now is Pipe Major Dennis Lowe and Piper Rob Tripp. So good to have you both with us today.
Well, thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Dennis, take us back that century. What brought these Scots immigrants to Flint and to mid-Michigan?
Well, at the time, it was where you could get a job. Most of these men that came to this country were coming because they were tradesmen. There wasn't a lot of work in the old country. They came here looking for a better life, just like immigrants today.
And there was work to be had in Flint.
Yep, there was work to be had. There was a society called the Clan Mackenzie, and the Clan Mackenzie basically gave these immigrants a place to get their feet on the ground. They set them up with a place to stay, made sure that they knew how to get around town, made sure that they got to their job. The Clan Mackenzie was almost like a halfway house for immigrants at the time. And they also sponsored the pipe band, which gave a focus for their Scottish culture.
What kind of jobs were they taking?
Well, most of these guys were skilled tradesmen. Mm-hmm. They were tool makers. They were sheet metal workers. They were plumbers, pipe fitters. You know, all the trades that you would need in a plant.
And the idea of having a Highland band to connect these immigrants with the old country, I think, Rob, that just, you can't even put a price on what that must have meant.
Having spent a couple of years myself overseas, it's easy to lose track of your home. And putting it together with people who've had the same experiences you have had to be a really, really powerful thing for them, because they're working in a different world in the new auto industry plants, very mechanized, driven. You know, it's a very different environment for them. You know, being with their friends from home and a sense of they brought it with them.
Well, and everything in this country, even today, to somebody from the old country is new.
Yes.
You know, my grandmother grew up in a house that was in the records of William the Conqueror in 1066. So she grew up in a house. So you come to this country and everything is new. That house was just built last week, you know, and you know, they're not used to that.
Now, you mentioned this Mackenzie group. Was this kind of the way we've seen, like, for example, Little Caesars sponsoring little kids playing hockey?
Mackenzie clan was actually, you call it a fraternal or benevolent society.
Okay.
Because that was back before Social Security, before medical insurance, all these things. They would provide mutual assistance if somebody needed help. You sign a contract. Mm. In fact, one of our historian in the band has the old record of the guys when they signed up and joined it, and they had to pay every month small money into that benevolent fund. Somebody got hurt, they get some money to help. You know, they got killed and would help with expenses for the family and so on. That's really – and there were lots of such societies.
So it wasn't like a business. It was really
let's help you get a good firm landing.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And thus the band wears the Mackenzie tartan?
That's it.
Well, the Mackenzie tartan is actually the tartan of the Seaforth Mackenzie Highlanders. And there were a couple of former members of the Seaforth Highlanders that joined the band, and they had kilts. Well, being Scots, you're not going to buy a whole new set of kilts when you've got two that are already there. So you just buy what you already have. Save money.
So when did the band officially form?
In 1916. That is our earliest record of the band actually being in existence. We've heard rumors that the band existed before that, but those are the first official records where the Clan Mackenzie Association is talking about sponsoring the band.
Before that, they couldn't get a sponsor, and the city of Flint would not let them charter without a sponsor. As early as 15, there was some conversation, certainly, but I understand 1916 is when they started it.
You know,
officially.
You stop and you realize to have something going uninterrupted for a century, it's pretty remarkable.
It really is.
What do you think has been the key to this band, you know, making pipe music in mid-Michigan and Flint for over a century?
Family. There's a family right now in our band, the Murray family. Their father was in the band. All of his sons, and there's Bill, George, Bob, Donnie, and then there was a sister as well. So there was like six members. And now it's children of Bill Murray, and grandchildren are coming into the band. So you've got three generations that have been active, three and four generations that have been active in the band.
Rob, when I think of the history that Flint has seen in this century, a lot of it very, very tough. Was there ever a point when the band was perhaps in danger?
Yeah, there are a lot of times. I mean, frankly, this is true. You know, it comes and goes, but there was enough core to keep it going. When things stabilized a bit, I'm sure during the Great Depression and times during the war and things, when it's just hard to keep it going. One of the fun stories we tell is that during World War II, a number of the members of the band were, because they were skilled tradesmen, they had deferments. They had to work in the auto industry, Arsenal Democracy. Their skills were needed. But they had to be in the military, so they joined the Home Guard, which is the predecessor of our National Guard. And they had a pipe band. Guess what? It was the Flint Scottish by another name. We have a photograph of them in the Home Guard pipe band, but they're the same guys.
So it is really kept out. We're talking about the history of the Flint Scottish pipe band, the oldest Highland pipe band in the state of Michigan and the 11th oldest in the nation. They have been doing it, making piping and drumming music in Flint for over 100 years as we talk with pipe major Dennis Lowe and piper Rob Tripp. Rob, tell us how the band has been part of Flint's community. In what ways does the band represent itself in Flint?
Well, you think of pipe bands as marching down the street in a parade and things like that and dancing. But we've also been involved in a number of civic things and, in fact, helping businesses start up a new business. Hammity Brothers, for years, very famous grocery store chain. A couple of brothers out of Lebanon started that. And over time, they discovered that they really wanted to have the band play every time they opened a new store. And every time they opened a new store, Flint Scottish was right there helping them with the grand opening.
There really is a feeling of being a citizen of Flint.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
A little about pipes, actually. We're talking about a very, very ancient instrument.
Oh, yes.
One thinks of it being used in war.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be what kind of tunes?
Well, those would be marches. Primarily would be like a 4-4 march is actually a route march. It's where you move troops across. 2-4 marches tend to be the charge, or 6-8 marches because they have much the same type of rhythm. And then you have the other tunes, like for dances and so forth, because dancing for the Highland regiments, on the night before a battle, the soldiers got out and danced. They danced. The sword dance is a dance of the night before a battle. They got out and they danced to have good luck in the battle tomorrow.
And then, of course, there are the laments.
There are the laments. The laments to celebrate the passing of the soldiers. The most famous one of those would be the Flowers of the Forest, to commemorate the dead in battles. Even some of the retreat marches. There's a very famous one called When the Battle is Over that Andy Stewart immortalized with words, which was written during the Boer War. And it's about the soldiers marching off and the ones that don't come home and, you know, the sadness that comes with war.
A lot of history in all of those tunes. I'm just curious, what brought each of you to piping? I'll start with you, Rob. What brought you to piping?
Kind of late middle age. I'd liked the music, really liked it, and said, let's figure this thing out. And I got one of those mail-order chanter sets, and then my neighbor, who was a piper herself, and said, you need a teacher. We got me a teacher, and sort of progressed from there, and I got rid of that one, got better stuff, and it's really enjoy. I like the music. I like the mental challenge, the physical challenge. It's really hard when you take it up in later in life to get the fingers to move like an 11-year-old kid can do.
Because we're talking like 32nd and 64th notes.
It's my third pipe band, and I really, really like the people in the band. From the day one I walked in, I said, I like these people.
And when did you start playing?
I took my first lessons in Flint when I was 12 years old, and I'm 56 now, so that's 44 years ago.
That's a lot of piping.
from the former pipe major of the Flint Scottish Pipe Band, Jim Murray, one of the Murrays again. It was one of those community ed things. So you signed up, you know, and you went to this school, and you got 10 weeks of lessons for, and then unfortunately, somehow or another, we miscommunicated. He didn't do the community ed thing anymore. And we lost touch. So I lost about a year until I found the band in Lake Orion, where I actually progressed up to where I got my first set of pipes. I wound up as pipe major of that band when I was 17 years old. And that's a challenge when you're 17 years old and trying to tell people that are as old as your parents how you want them to play their music.
And here you are now, pipe major of Flint Scottish. How many members in the band now?
We will commonly have about 20 to 25 at a practice. At our bigger events, we'll have 25 or 30 people. Total membership is probably closer to 50.
And how many are Flint and how many travel from who knows where? You're all over the place.
All over Southeast Michigan.
Yeah, we have people that come from Grand Rapids. Mm-hmm. We have people that come from the Detroit area, actually downriver area. Mm-hmm. I live in Saginaw. We're spread out.
But there's got to be a cognizant of the fact that when you are marching or when you are competing, that drum says Flint Scottish, that you are, in
absolutely.
A sense, representing Flint.
A great deal of pride in that.
Yes.
Well, I know you've got your big winner, Cayley, coming this Saturday. It's a big fundraiser. And I know for those who don't know the word Cayley, it's a Gaelic word for party with dancing and music. In other words, a really, really good time.
Yes, absolutely.
So tell us a little about that. What's going to be going on Saturday night?
4 pipe bands. We're going to have a dancing. We're going to have a really nice Celtic band, Roan, playing. In fact, we have a couple of unique arrangements where we play and they sing. It's really a special treat to hear that. And, of course, there's the Scottish food from Aykroyd's. We'll have a couple of vendors there and just a really fun evening.
It's at the Knights of Columbus Hall in Davison. And you can get all the details by going to flintscottish.com. And I suspect if you go to flintscottish.com, finding yourself maybe wanting to learn to be a piper or to be a drummer, you can find information there as well.
Absolutely. We maintain both piping and drumming schools.
Pipe Major Dennis Lowe and Piper Rob Tripp of the Flint Scottish Pipe Band, the oldest in Michigan, 11th oldest in the nation. Congratulations on the first century of bringing that Scottish tradition to Flint.
And working on being around for another 200 or 300 more.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Glad to be here.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Some parents in Michigan may wind up having to drive their kids 10, 20, even 30 miles to school next year. But these parents still aren't sure if that's going to be the case or if any of their options will be any better than their current schools. All of the confusion is because last month the State School Reform Office, the SRO, announced that 38 schools could be closed at the end of the school year. The SRO has deemed these schools as failing because they've been ranked in the bottom 5% academically for three straight years. Michigan Radio's Lindsay Smith and Jen Guerra are here now to help us sort through all the uncertainty this has caused, including a letter sent by the Governor's School Reform Office to parents of students in these targeted schools. Here's Kalamazoo mother Brianna Wolverton describing what it was like to find that letter in her mail.
Came home from work and opened the mail, doing my normal routine, and I had a letter. And when I tell you I was heartbroken to read that my son's school would possibly close. It was a really stressful day. I think maybe 3 days later, I sat down with my son and I showed him the letter. And his first thought was, does that mean I'm a failure? And that was devastating. And in the days since, we have a conversation every night about how he's not a failure. Yeah, horrible, horrible. It's hard not to get emotional when I think about it because it's just this whole process has been horrible.
So here we have this letter sent out by the school reform office directly to parents who have kids at one of these 38 schools targeted for closure. Jen, what was in the letter? Can you read part of it for us?
Sure. This is from a Detroit parent. Give me this letter. So it says, "Dear parent or guardian, you are receiving this letter because," insert school name, "is at risk of being closed by June 30th, 2017 due to academic failure for many years. We are working to improve the opportunities for all children to get a good education. Part of that process may include offering your child the opportunity to attend a higher performing school." And then there's, you know, some more in there. And then it says, "For the next 30 days, we will work with your local school district and community to finalize this decision. We will be looking at other public school options for your child. If we determine that closing your school would create a hardship because there are no better options at this time, we will not close the school. You will receive an update about the decision by the end of February, beginning of March."
Wow. And Jen, what are you hearing from Detroit parents? Is the clip we heard from the Kalamazoo mom pretty representative of what you're hearing in Detroit?
Yeah, I would definitely say that. That letter is really what sparked everything. And people are... It left a lot of questions and not a lot of answers.
And Lindsay, why is this? Why did this letter cause so much confusion all around the state for parents, for students, and for school administrators?
Well, the state did not tell administrators that this letter was going out. So the school districts, the administrators that I talked to, I mean, they were fielding questions all of a sudden from parents. You know, you can imagine the phone calls that started coming in that afternoon. "Hey, I just got this letter from the state. You know, what in the world is this?" in harder terms in some instances. And the superintendents were kind of like, "Oh, you know," I mean, they knew that this was a possibility, but they didn't like how it was handled, that the state just sort of sent them out to parents without giving them a heads up, because they're the ones that really kind of had to deal with a lot of these phone calls. The other thing for parents, I mean, they don't, a lot of parents, I think, don't necessarily separate the local school district from the Michigan Department of Education versus, in this case, the school reform office, which isn't a part of the Department of Ed anymore. And so it just creates this sort of confusion among parents that's like, why don't you guys know what's going on and why can't you tell me any answers? So it's really frustrating, that process, I think.
Remind us again just how these schools got on that list, Jen.
Well, there is a law, it's 1280C, that says, it established the School Reform Office, the SRO, and it says, you know, the state can come in and close schools that are failing. It's just that the state never did that before. And then Governor Snyder moved that office from the Department of Ed, where he felt things weren't really, you know, moving in the way he wanted them to move. And he moved it over to a department that he has oversight of. And that was sort of a signal like, okay, we're going to start taking things seriously.
The gloves are off.
Right, exactly. And then there's also a law that happened with the bailout in Detroit. And that law is called Public Act 192. And that law said, you know, with this bailout, you also have to close any schools in Detroit that have three consecutive years of failing test scores. So that triggered the Detroit schools. And then the SRO was sort of like, well, we're going to apply this, you know, statewide, because why treat one district differently, right? And again, they have the power to do that. And so they did.
A majority of schools on this closure list are in Detroit. And we know last week some members of the Detroit City Council and the city's legislative delegation had a big community meeting trying to clarify things for parents. Natasha Baker, who's the head of the school reform office, was not there. But Rich Baird, who's one of the governor's senior advisors, was at the meeting. And here's what he said.
We have to think about closure in terms of closing out failure, not closing out schools, not closing out buildings, and not closing out effective educational offerings.
Lindsay, what's he saying here?
You know, it's very difficult for me to answer that question. I mean, I think my hunch here is that they're trying to say, look, we're not trying to... It's difficult. I think that this is the problem. Closing schools is never going to go down well with communities and with parents and with neighborhoods that those schools are in. And so the state is trying to, in their mind, give sort of this ultimatum, like turn this around or else. And this is where it gets to the what else, you know, or else. And it's like it's trying to couch it to say, you know, don't think of this as a school closure. Think of it as an opportunity. Jen might, you know, I don't, there's also some ways to look at this as where is this going in the future? And there might be some new options sort of presenting themselves on the table as sort of the state figures out how and if they're actually going to close, you know, take this step, which to people, you know, a lot of parents is really dramatic.
Oh, yeah. Closing a school, no doubt, is political. It's personal. It's emotional. You know, there's like an entire genre of YouTube videos that show protests around school closings, right? And what Lindsay said, I totally agree with. And also, I think what she was alluding to is there does seem to be maybe a possibility of something. When I spoke with the state superintendent of schools, Brian Whiston, he talked about this quote-unquote partnership model. Again, not really sure how it would work. It would reconstitute the school. So you're closing the building, you're closing the school, and then you're reopening it in a new form. And maybe you're replacing some of the staff. It's not necessarily charter. It could still be within the district. But again, you know, it's more questions than answers.
Lots of questions. And we're talking about something that could happen at the end of this school year.
Yes.
Right. Well, and actually, the SRO says they are going to have answers by, you know, beginning of March.
As people have gotten these letters and raised Cain all over the state, have we gotten any clarifications from the Snyder administration?
I would say no, not really. And I think something that Lindsay and I have both talked about at length is, you know, in this so parents got this letter that I read part of. They also then got a list of possible districts that they could send their child to if the school closes. You know, it says in the letter, we're going to be looking at other public school options for your child. Okay, great. So they have these lists, again, just districts, not schools. And you start looking at the lists, and some of these districts don't take kids from outside of the district. If it's not an adjacent district, there might not be seats available for those children. And also, they're not necessarily better. Some of the schools in these districts are in the 12th percentile, which is just slightly better than a failing school. So if the whole point of closing a school is to raise student achievement, that's a problem if you're sending kids to schools that are just marginally better.
And with this letter, doesn't there have to be a higher performing school within a certain geographic location from the school that is being closed? I think the language in the law was closing a school cannot cause unreasonable hardship. What qualifies as an unreasonable hardship?
That's the million-dollar question right now.
Yeah, I think, Natasha Baker, the officer for the school reform office, she defines it as a school that's in the 25th percentile or higher within 30 miles.
30 miles is far.
30 miles is far. I mean, in Detroit, the U.S. Census Bureau shows that only, it shows that one out of four households do not have a car. And schools of choice, which allow you to go to schools in another district. Schools of choice does not require that district to provide transportation. So it is up to the parent to get the kid there. And I've asked multiple people, including the SRO, if they have a plan for transportation for these kids. And there is no plan.
There's no plan. Lindsay, you've been talking with people in Muskegon Heights and Kalamazoo. What kind of options did people get there?
Yeah, I mean, transportation is definitely, you're looking at a big issue. In Muskegon Heights, it's kind of different. This is the thing that I run into a lot in Muskegon Heights is really they just got out from under the control of an emergency manager. So they have sort of a little bit of a different situation where they, you know, for financial reasons, just got out from under the state, and they have a letter from the governor essentially saying that they cannot close their high school because of the state has loaned this district so much money to keep it afloat. So I don't really see how closing the high school is going to benefit the district or the state taxpayers. I don't think Treasury has really been looped in on some of these school reform office decisions because you have other school districts that have fallen under the emergency manager law. Benton Harbor Schools is another one that has some schools at risk for closure under the school reform office that is working with Treasury to resolve financial issues. It's not clear to me that Treasury is talking to school reform and vice versa. So those are a lot of big unanswered questions. I think transportation is a huge issue. And also when you're talking about some of these high schools, I think Saginaw, Pontiac, Muskegon Heights, sometimes when these high school close, you've seen this in Muskegon Heights a few years ago when they restarted the district. When you restart a school or you just say that a school is going to close, a lot of those kids that are at 16, say you're age 16, 17, 18, if you're going to have to drive 40 miles away to go to a school that you may not feel you fit in, a lot of those kids just end up dropping out. We saw that in Muskegon Heights. And I think there's worry in some of those schools that at the high school level that this could lead to, you know, some of those same problems of kids just kind of falling off the radar, falling through the cracks.
Totally. And in Detroit specifically, you know, the district's research shows that when they went through this whole closure wave about a decade ago, they were losing a third of kids every time a school closed. So you have to ask yourself, like, what's the tipping point here, right? So if you're closing 5, 10, 15, 25 schools in Detroit, and if that research still holds up that they're losing a third of kids each time a school closes because they leave the district or they go to a charter, how much can Detroit survive? How much can the school district survive?
I mean, this gets to this question of whether closing a school actually brings about improvements. In fact, here's Detroit City Council member Raquel Castaneda-Lopez reading a question from a parent at last week's meeting with state officials.
Please present any data that shows school closures helps Detroit students do better. So if you have any stats from the representatives from the governor's office.
And state officials had no answer there. So Jen, what does the research show? What happens when low-performing schools are closed?
Well, that person asks a really good question. Two things to note. One, we don't have very much research at all on what happens when a school closes in Detroit. I did a whole documentary on this. We couldn't find any research except for one sort of statewide piece of research. Where we do see research is in Chicago and New York, and those show that closing a school and moving kids to another school only really improves academic outcomes if you are sending those kids to a significantly better school. So in Chicago, the first study they did around that showed that those kids had to be, if they were coming from a failing school, those displaced kids had to be moved to a school that was in the top quartile, so 75th percentile or higher. Natasha Baker's plan is putting kids in 25th percentile or higher. And again, it's not even clear that that is true because the schools we have looked at are below the 25th percentile because she doesn't identify or because the SRO doesn't identify schools. It just identifies districts. So long and short of it is, you know, closing a school to raise academic achievement can work if you're sending kids to significantly better schools, but there really aren't enough seats, right, to accommodate all those kids.
Well, let's look ahead at what's next in this ordeal. I'm sure lawsuits are being talked about. Who's announced intentions, Lindsay, to go to court to stop this?
Well, Kalamazoo and Saginaw schools are teaming up. They intend to file a lawsuit in the state court of claims. They're basically saying that the school reform office does not have the authority to close schools. Basically, Kalamazoo's superintendent put it like this. If you want to close a school in your community, run for school board and close the school. So they haven't really outlined their legal argument here, but they're saying that they don't believe the state has the authority to do that.
Are you hearing anything, Jen?
I think I'm pretty sure that Detroit, the school board gave approval to file a lawsuit if needed. Right. Yeah, it's just a wait and see at this
yes,
point.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. What's happening in the legislature with efforts to repeal and replace this law? I mean, is there any possibility that new legislation could come in and head off these closings?
Yes. Republican Senator Phil Pavlo, he chairs the Senate Education Committee. He's trying to repeal and replace 1280C, which established the State Reform Office and gives it the authority to close schools. But his timeline is different than the SRO's timeline. So the SRO is saying we're going to have these announcements by end of February, beginning of March. And Senator Pavlo, when I spoke with him, he said he doesn't want to put a timeline on it because he wants to find the best replacement, not just any replacement. So maybe by summer. But I'm not sure if it would be retroactive if those decisions have already gone out. There's a lot of confusion.
If I'm a mom, I'm just thinking of Brianna, who we heard at the very beginning of this. I'd be pulling my hair out right now, wondering what is going to happen and where will my baby be come fall. And I think it's important to note that most of these schools are in low-income, predominantly minority neighborhoods. What does that say more broadly about what's happening here, Lindsay?
Well, I mean, this is the thing about some of these standardized tests and sort of looking at these certain factors. You're going to... As one parent put it to me, congratulations, state, you found where the poverty is. I mean, they feel like the state just keeps going after them and not really giving them the resources to empower their local districts. They feel like in many cases, like on this side of the state, like I said, Benton Harbor, Muskegon Heights, they've been through these emergency managers and they've been through reforms. And they feel like they can't hold on long enough to get something to stick in some cases. They say, look, we're growing. We have growth, but we're not achieving as well on the standardized tests. And in these cases, that's what they're looking at. The school reform office is saying you need to translate that growth into achievement. It's sort of almost a philosophical debate, I feel like, at some level, Jen. I mean, right?
Yeah, I would agree. I would agree with all of that. And that's also what Detroit is saying, too. It's like, listen, we've been under state control for so many years now. We've just gotten our board back. Give us a shot. And that's where we stand.
Much to watch. Well, we appreciate you bringing us up to speed on all of these movable parts. Clearly, not all of them talking well to each other and not well coordinated. And as this evolves, we'll be checking in with you again, our Jen Guerra and our Lindsay Smith. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks.
My pleasure.
Today's Stateside was directed by Mike Blank, and our engineer was Rusty Brock. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Our contributors are Allie Billings, Mercedes Mejia, Lindsay Scullin, Josh Hakala, Lise Mesmer, and Nick Wallace. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks so much for listening.